And welcome to the David Shaler Show once again. Here I am, David Shaler, back in the studio after last week's efforts knee-deep in the mud at the Truth Festival near Bristol. And I have to say, we had a great time that weekend. We exchanged a lot of information. A lot of people there got together as a result of wanting to know more truth about 9/11, but then shared many other truths, ranging from a whole series of issues, ranging from Zionism to the Freemasons to free energy to forms of alternative health and things like Tai Chi and so on. So we had a great weekend. This week has been an interesting week again, basically, to show you how far it's gone in America now. They're putting forward a bill that they're actually now calling the Torture Bill. And it appears that under this bill, even American citizens can be actually tried by military tribunals now. And in fact, we've had a legal professor commenting on this in the LA Times and says basically that the legislation authorizes the president to seize American citizens as enemy combatants, even if they've never left the United States. And once thrown into military prison, they can't even expect a trial by their peers or any of the normal protections of the Bill of Rights. And it's a dangerously broad definition of an illegal enemy combatant. So, once again, the war on terror is proven to be anything but. It's creating more and more terror. In fact, this is the proof that this is a war on freedom. And this is not messing around with civil liberties in the margins anymore. This is going right to the very heart of what we consider to be the values of civilization, that we don't put people in prison without trial, that we don't torture people in any circumstances. Because, as I said time and time on this programme, torture does not work. It is as simple as that. Anybody who's not a terrorist will tell you anything to make the torture stop. Anybody who is a terrorist, of course, will be trained to give out false information and false leads. And I'm pretty sure, in fact, we know, in fact, from reading the 9/11 Commission report, that they show that they have taken information that was obtained effectively under torture. They don't use the word torture in the report, of course, but it's quite clear what they're talking about. And I believe this is the way they've managed to get Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to confess, in inverted commas, to his operatives planting explosives in buildings. Now, why are they doing that? Well, to me, it's patently obvious, because the towers were brought down by controlled demolition. They've tried to argue this for the last 5 years that it wasn't. We in the 9/11 Truth Movement are saying that they were. And we've been vindicated, basically. So now, of course, they're going to have to try and pretend that Al-Qaeda somehow got into the Twin Towers and Building 7 and placed all those explosives at strategic points, at the strategic joist to bring the building down. Now, if security was that lax at the World Trade Center complex after the attacks in 1993, well, you almost think they would deserve to be attacked by Al-Qaeda in those circumstances. But, of course, that's not the case, because Al-Qaeda didn't attack them. And the other big story, of course, is the information about the release of the recent Bin Laden videos, in which Bin Laden was, of course, shown meeting two of the September 11 hijackers. And what we've actually found is that although this is reported in the mainstream media as a new video released by Al-Qaeda and so on, it's actually appeared in a documentary, which the name of it just which escapes me. The documentary was The Road to Guantanamo, that's right. Which is just absolutely extraordinary that the entire mainstream media can tell us that this is a new video released by Al-Qaeda. And in fact, it's not. It's something that's been shown in The Road to Guantanamo. And it's actually startling, because The Road to Guantanamo actually shows that British and American intelligence agencies used doctored footage to show detainees in which their likenesses have been edited with CGI, that's computer-generated images used by Hollywood and so on, into the Bin Laden rally scene, using it, well, therefore, to intimidate them into confessing to being Al-Qaeda members. Well, that seems to me rather counterproductive, because presumably anybody's going to say, well, that's not me. But, of course, anybody under torture will admit to anything. And I think it's, again, completely cowardly on the part of the authorities, as we saw in this country when the British citizens who'd been detained there were released. We had leaks to the press and everything else, even though they weren't even, you know, there was nothing the police could do against them or anything else. I mean, clearly they'd said things under torture, but the Americans tried to make something of that. So yeah, that's the shape of things this week. But in terms of our sort of truth radio and alternative knowledge, we have something slightly different this week, and I just wanted to play that to you. On today's programme, we have Jeff Stray, who's the author of Beyond 2012. Obviously, 2012, to anybody who's into esoteric information or the spiritual stuff, is a date of enormous significance, and we know it probably best from the fact that it's the known as the Mayan end date, the end date of the long count calendar, and therefore of the end of the final Mayan period. But it's not just the Mayans who've talked about this date. It seems to range across cultures, across science, and even people having near-death experiences report receiving strange information about 2012. Now, obviously, the change that we're about to undergo could be something as extraordinary as an apocalypse, or it could be the greatest thing that's ever happened to mankind, or certainly perhaps the greatest thing if we perhaps exceed the fifth dimension, as some people have suggested. But anyway, Jeff's book, Beyond 2012, looks at all of this stuff. So hello, Jeff.
Hello. Yeah, good to see you.
So can you tell us what you were doing when you first sort of started or first got into the whole issue of 2012?
Yeah, it was about 24 years ago. I was working as a bus driver. And I was reading a book by Robert Anton Wilson called The Cosmic Trigger, The Final Secret of the Illuminati. And he'd written that as an explanation of the previous trilogy, a fictional trilogy he'd written about the Illuminati called Illuminatus. And I had quite a bit of trouble getting hold of that book. In those days, there was no internet, and getting hold of American books was quite difficult anyway. But I managed to get hold of a copy of this Cosmic Trigger, and in it there was a summary of a book by someone called Terence McKenna and his brother Dennis. The summary of this book was about 4 or 5 pages long, quite a chunk of the Cosmic Trigger, and it explained how Terence and his brother had gone down to the Ecuador rainforest to try and get hold of something that's now quite familiar to people, but in those days no one had heard of it apart from anthropologists, which is the jungle brew called ayahuasca. So they made it into the rainforest. They had a slightly different combination than is usual with ayahuasca, but they had they smoked the bark of the ayahuasca and combined that with a mushroom. But in fact, the chemical constituents were exactly, very, very similar, because what's in the mushroom is closely related to the chemical that's in the ayahuasca brew.
Now, is that DMT, is it?
Yes, dimethyltryptamine, DMT, is what's in the ayahuasca brew, and in the mushroom, it's a 4-phosphloroxy DMT. It's a sort of variation on DMT. If you take pure DMT, it's a very, very quick experience. It's completely metabolized in your body within about 10 minutes, because your body is very familiar with the molecule. The reason is that it is actually made inside our own bodies under certain circumstances. There's been a lot of research done on that recently by a man called Rick Strassman. The way that McKenna described his experience, I've never heard anybody describe it exactly the same as him, but there's a lot in common with people's descriptions of it, and that is, his description was that you go down, you're sort of sucked down this tunnel into an underground space and confronted by these beings, which he described as a jewel-encrusted basketballs. Or he calls them self-transforming machine elves or tykes. Right. And they bounce towards you and they communicate you with, not by an audible form of communication, they communicate by morphing lumps of themselves out like Fabergé eggs and presenting it to you. And then they encourage you to use your voice, and as you use your voice, you produce these glittery objects and present them to the elves, and they know what you mean.
All right.
So it's a really bizarre thing that's going on. But during the course of this experience in the Amazon, this communication they had with these entities lasted with him and his brother. It was a shared hallucination or vision, which lasted about 34 days. And during that time, they got information that told them that everything that happens in the universe is encoded into the ancient Chinese oracle called the I Ching. The I Ching is the Book of Change. And the idea is that everything new that happens can somehow... it's somehow been encoded into the I Ching, and the idea was that it could be somehow mathematically extracted and turned into a graph that we could then use to see where we are on the graph. The one that the time wave is based on, which McKenna generated out of the I Ching, is based on the King Wen sequence, and that is a very strange sequence. And what struck him about it was that it was a very that it had been put in that very order for a particular reason, because there's several things about it that are very unusual. If you take each hexagram and compare it with the one that follows in that King Wen sequence, the one that follows is either an inverted version of the previous one, or it's completely opposite, where each, because of the, I should just explain that the hexagrams are made up of six lines of yin or yang, yeah, solid and broken lines. So in some cases, the six lines were a complete opposite of the one previously, either that or the whole thing had been turned upside down. So that told him that, among other things about it, that that it was intentionally ordered in that sequence. So they had to extract all the information from about all the changes between each hexagram and the subsequent hexagram, and they did it on several different levels and in two directions, then combined all that information mathematically, came up with a series of numbers which they turned into a graph. That graph then showed all the change in the universe from the beginning of time to the end of time, but it was fractalized, and this was before fractals had even been conceived of by Mandelbrot, who coined the term. But McKenna called it a wave hierarchy, basically, where you've got the same shape encapsulated within itself at smaller and smaller levels. So the idea was, when it was eventually converted into a computer program, you could zoom in on it and see the same graph repeating at smaller and smaller levels, and that you get harmonics between those levels, where events at smaller levels harmonise with events at larger levels.
And what sort of events are we talking about here?
Well, the smallest levels of the wave measure the events that take place at a subatomic event level, which is the time it takes for particles like electrons to go round the atom of a nucleus, round the nucleus of an atom, rather.
So this is a good example, again, of where the alternative knowledge from the past, the ancient knowledge, seems to have predated all the modern science and so on. That'd be right?
Yes. Well, whether the people that generated the I Ching were aware of all these connections or not, or whether this was intuitively compacted into it so that it worked as an oracle, is another question. But the fact is, if you take the smallest levels that I mentioned, which where the electron going around the nucleus of an atom, and each level of this wave is 64 times greater than the one below, you multiply up. Right. It only takes 26 levels before you get to the age of the universe.
Yeah, right, of course. Yeah, yeah.
And so when they'd got this fractalized wave, a modular wave hierarchy, that's the term.
Modular wave hierarchy, right, okay.
They were then able to, well, in order to find out where we were on the wave, they had to then try and graph history so that they could line up history, the graph of history, with the graph that they produced from the I Ching. And the graph, by the way, from the I Ching, it shows, it goes in the opposite direction from a normal graph. That confuses a lot of people, because as you get more change happening, the graph peaks downwards, because the idea is, unlike a normal graph where they can keep going upwards, when it goes downwards there's a maximum level of novelty.
Yeah.
What it does is measures the ingression of novelty into space-time. That means the amount of new things that are happening which have never happened before. And the nearer you get to the end of the wave, the more new things are happening, and the accelerating, as more and more of the wavelets start to get closer to the meeting point where they all meet together at the end point, that's the point where you have the maximum novelty, which is measured as zero on the graph, hence he called it time wave zero.
And I suppose that, obviously, the most obvious manifestation of that, I presume, would be technological change in the last sort of 150 years or so.
Oh, it certainly matches up very well to what we know about acceleration of change, as it is accelerating now before our eyes.
And what particular events on the time wave of our times would be of particular interest?
Well, the event that he used to correlate the time wave to history was the explosion of the bomb over Hiroshima in 1945. When he'd found that the Hiroshima event seemed to line up perfectly with this big peak on the wave, he then looked forward and found that the wave hits the baseline originally on the 17th of November 2012. So when I read about this, I had heard nothing about the Maya calendar, and McKenna himself had heard nothing about the Maya calendar. It wasn't until he brought out his second edition in 1993, because the original came out in 1975. In the second edition, he'd, in the interim, heard about the Maya calendar and made a slight adjustment to his endpoint of 34 days to bring it into alignment with the Maya calendar.
Right, so with the time wave, it is open to interpretation, it's less certain. But when we move on to the Mayan prophecy, from what I understand of people working this out, we are absolutely clear that the Mayan end date is either the 21st or the 23rd of December 2012. That's right, isn't it? Yeah.
That's true, yes. There's two. Those are the two major correlations that that are popular with the Mayanists, the specialists in these studies.
And can we just talk a little bit about the background of the Mayan calendar itself? I mean, we're talking about the long count calendar here, aren't we?
Yes. The Maya had a 260-day calendar called the Dzogchen, which means count of days. I mean, that is actually a transliteration. They're not sure what most of them called it. I think the one bunch of Maya that's still around call it the Sholkij, which is actually the same thing, the count of days. But it's a 260-day calendar, and this is of interest because it fits into a sort of hierarchy of calendars. They had several different calendars. This one was the sacred calendar, which was like a personal astrology. The day you're born on gives you a certain characteristic, which is the result of a combination of one of 13 numbers and 20 day signs. It takes 260 days to get the complete combination. So it's been a mystery until the 70s when two anthropologists went to live with the Maya as to why they have a 260-day calendar. And they asked them why this strange period, and they said it's to do with human gestation.
Yeah, well, 260 days would be the human gestation period, wouldn't it? Mm.
The Dzogchen is the interesting thing. The calendar we're talking about is the long count calendar, but it actually fits into this whole structure of the Dzogchen because it consists of 260 smaller sub-cycles, in this case called Khatuns. A Khatun is just under 20 years, and 260 of those comes out as 5,200 tuns, which in solar years is about 5,125 years. The cycle was zeroed out in 3114 BC, which is what they would call, the Maya would call, a day of creation. And then it goes through this whole series of cycles until it reaches the next day of creation after 13 baktuns, which is in 2012, in December 2012.
We could equate this with some kind of second coming then or something, yeah?
Well, it's a
second coming, I suppose,
yes,
which is common to most, common to a lot of cultures on Earth, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is very similar to that. And
I mean, it's like the Arthur myth, for example, or the Jesus myth, that they're going to come back and save us, basically.
See, until recently, some people had criticised all this interpretation of the end of the Mayan calendar as not being based in fact, not being based on any inscriptions that have survived, apart from a few of these post-conquest writings which had been influenced by Spanish apocalyptic ideas. They'd, for example, tried to write into these Chilambalan prophecies that the people, the Maya, had predicted the coming of the Spanish and were welcoming it, whereas in fact they wiped out loads of them. In fact, on Cuba, not one man, woman, or child was left alive. Mm. In fact, there has been, known mainly to just a small group of miners, there has been on not a very well-known site called Tortuguero, there's been a monument there which they've known about for 30 years. This only really came out into the public domain this April because a guy, an anthropologist called Robert Sittler, wrote an essay which was put on the internet sort of criticising this whole 2012 study as being based on nothing, because there's nothing in the inscriptions. And I told him some facts about the Chilambalan prophecies that implied, I should just explain that first. These prophecies that I mentioned, like the Kukulcan return one, there's stuff in there that implies that they were originally prophecies that were linked to the end of the long count calendar, in other words, 2012. And he said, actually, I'll give you a new translation of it. And it translated as unequivocally, it was referring to the end of the long count in 2012, because you've got 13 Baktun sign and the 4 Ahau and the 3 Kankian. Those are glyphs from 3 calendars that all coincide on one day, and it can only be the end of the 13 Baktun cycle in 2012. says on that day, the nine support gods will return to the, and then we can't fill in the last word because there's a big crack through the monument.
Oh my God, this terrible thing, these terrible situations. Well, that's interesting. We're talking about the nine support gods.
Yes.
Now, and what do you think they are?
Well, these nine gods are mentioned in the Chulalongkorn prophecies. They're sometimes seen as one god, and sometimes they're talked about as nine separate gods. The name for them is Bolon Yoptiku, translates as the nine dog tree god.
Nine dog tree god. My God, that's quite strange. Yes, these literal translations, but yes.
Yes, so I mean, some people are now looking into, like John Major Jenkins has been looking into what this could mean and where these gods have actually cropped up before.
Something to do with the dog star, because we always come back to Sirius A and B, don't we? These things and the Dogon and people like that. Has anybody explored that?
There hasn't been a direct connection found in this case yet. Mm-hmm. But there does seem to be this god does seem to be peeping out behind some when they've done these pictures of the world tree, which represents the Earth's axis. This nine dog tree god is sort of peeping out from behind the Earth's axis, basically. So, and the fact is that in 2012, what is going to happen astronomically is that the Earth's axis will be pointing toward the centre of the galaxy, really.
Right, yeah, because I want to talk a bit about this. I mean, we've sort of obviously now got the background to this of why the end date's important. I just want to talk a little bit more about that first before we come on to that. We've talked about the sort of time wave, but it's not just the Mayan culture that's coming up this sort of end date or thereabouts, is it? It's other cultures as well.
That's right, yes. I mentioned when you started asking me about this, 24 years ago, I found out about the time wave, first of all, and it wasn't another 4 years or so till I found out that the Maya also had this endpoint that was only 34 days after the Chinese I Ching endpoint. So then I started looking around to see if I could find information from other cultures, and eventually set up the website, diagnosis2012.co.uk, to gather information from all over the world. And it turns out that there are many other cultures that do have myths that fit exactly into this. For example, closer to where the Maya are, you have the Hopi Native Americans who live in Arizona. Now, they say that they are related via the Anasazi to the Aztecs, and they're sort of basically they have got the same ancestors. But the Hopi have a series of myths about previous worlds, as they call them.
So how do these ceremonies of the Hopi Indians then relate to 2012?
Right, well, they have this ceremony every year in an underground chamber called a kiva. The ceremony is called Wuwuchim. At the height of the ceremony, it culminates when the Pleiades are overhead at midnight. So the fact that the Hopi were using this same Pleiades, the movement of the Pleiades being a check on the movement of precession. It's precession that the Maya were measuring with their long calendar. In the case of the Maya, they were the end point coincides with the rising of the winter solstice sun on the galactic equator. So that is an event that happens only every 26,000 years, and it only lasts for about 36 years because the sun is half a degree wide, and so it takes 72 years for 1 degree of precession. So only 36 years for the sun to cross the galactic equator, and that's when our axis will be pointing toward the centre of the galaxy, because the astronomical centre of the galaxy is just off the galactic plane, but the visual centre of the galaxy is right there on the galactic plane. Astronomically speaking, that the centre of that 36-year process was 1998 or 1999. So some people think the Maya were 13 or 14 years out with that, but although it's still an incredible achievement to project forward from a 2,500 years or so with their calendar, from a non-technological society to most people don't think it's possible. Mm. But there are a lot of indications, as you mentioned, this information's coming up from a lot of other places, other cultures, and people who've had visions from altered states of consciousness.
Oh, this is what I find particularly fascinating, is the fact that we were talking earlier on about this DMT substance, and apparently the body secretes DMT at the moment of birth and the moment of death, but also, as we're talking, by taking ayahuasca or magic mushrooms or whatever. But also, obviously, clearly, people who had near-death experiences will get a surge of DMT. Mm. And this is what I find perhaps in some ways most fascinating, if you could just tell us a little bit about people who have had these experiences.
Well, the most famous near-death experience is probably Danyon Brinkley. And he was speaking on the telephone in 1975 when a huge bolt of electricity hit the telephone line and threw him physically up to the ceiling of the room. And then he fell down on the floor and was out of body from that point. He died on the way to hospital, but he came back to life 28 minutes later, which was then the longest known near-death experience. And he came back to consciousness with a sheet over him, stiff as a board, on a trolley being wheeled to the morgue with a death certificate having been issued.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
So what he said when he came back, well, after he recovered, obviously, it took him about a year just to be able to walk again after that. He said that when he was in the ambulance, a tunnel opened up in front of him. It was floating above his body. A tunnel opened up. He was sucked down this tunnel into a very bright light, and was confronted by a bright silver being, and then he kind of went through a personal judgment process in a non-time situation where he relived everything in his life, every thought and deed he'd ever done that affected or impacted on anybody else. So he felt the emotion that he caused other people, everything he'd done, all the good things as well as the bad things. And in his case, he'd been in the Marines and he'd actually killed people, so he had a lot of angst to go through, a lot of where he felt the pain and also the grief of the relatives of the people that he killed, but right down to smaller things where he just affected people by things he'd said. And he also felt the good that he'd done to people as well. And it's a long process, of course, but then it was in a non-time sort of situation, and he came out of that process and he was taken to visit 12 more of these beings in a circle with a 13th in the centre, and they all in turn presented him with something like a TV screen where he saw events that were to happen in the future. And there were, well, hundreds of these events, about 300 events, I think, between 1975 and the end of the process in 2012. And by 2002, nearly all of these, apart from 17 of these, had come to pass. These included major world events like the falling of the Berlin Wall and the Chernobyl incident, all of which he'd seen beforehand. But among these predictions he was given was that in 2012, at the end of all these culminating series of earth changes and severe weather changes that we are now seeing, the whole process would culminate in a spiritual opportunity for mankind, and a magnetic pole shift of the Earth.
Right, so that's interesting stuff, because the magnetic pole shift, because other people have talked about that as well, haven't they? Because the magnetic resonance, I think it's called, of the Earth is declining, isn't it?
That's right, yes, it's been going down, we're told, for the last 2,000 years, and they've modelled these things that happen quite regularly on, well, they happen... They've happened many times before, anyway, on the Earth. I think 780,000 years ago is the last official time where the magnetic poles reverse completely. But there has been partial reversals. But they've modelled it in the laboratory, and it happens when the strength of the Earth's field diminishes over a long period, and then you start to get up bubblings of field which are reversed, and that's already happening off the coast of South Africa. We are getting an area where there's already a reversed magnetic field. So some scientists say we are now actually in the first stages of a geomagnetic reversal.
And what effect would that have if it were to happen?
Well, to a technological society, it would be much more dramatic than it might have been if we hadn't been a technological society, because it will probably burn out all the little black boxes. All our vehicles seem to work. I mean, the old kind of Land Rovers used to have contact breaker points, but we've got all these little black boxes now. The likelihood is they'll all be burned out, so there'll be a complete failure of cars. Now, whether that will include aeroplanes, I don't know, but it's quite possible.
And the rate of which this magnetic resonance is declining, what then that suggests, presumably, that something's going to happen in 2012 with the switch. It's going to happen then.
Yes. I've noticed that the Monroe Institute, who do they teach people to have out-of-body experiences, they've noticed that when people are having an out-of-body experience, the polarity of their body reverses. So I just sort of wondered if that means that if the polarity of the Earth reverses, will that cause a mass out-of-body experience? I don't know. I mean, a lot of geologists say this is a very long process that can't happen suddenly, but there is an outcrop of rock called the Steens Glacier, I think, somewhere, maybe in Norway. But that this has got some varied bits of rock outcrop which show different magnetic polarities, and they can work out from those that over a period of just a few weeks, basically, that it is possible for the whole of the Earth's magnetic field to switch in about 6 weeks.
Right, so it is possible. That is possible. Mm. And talking about this sort of scientific stuff as well, I mean, something you did mention earlier on, and something I'm probably not sure I really understand, but which you need to explain to me, is the galactic superwave. This is the other theory of what may happen in 2012. And this is to do with the alignment of the planets and the galaxy and everything else, isn't it?
This is Paul LaViolette, who's an American astrophysicist. Yes, he's done a lot of analysis, a lot of it on ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica, showing that there seems to be a regularity about the way that the Earth is showered with certain kinds of radiation that accompany a wave that comes from galactic centre. The idea is that at the centre of the galaxy, most people think that there's a black hole there, but LaViolette sort of doesn't think that. But he thinks it puts out a regular periods. It pumps out a big, there's an explosion and a wave front that goes throughout the whole galaxy, followed by, that is followed by what he calls a cosmic dust incursion. So the idea is when this happens, it's what he would call a double catastrophe. First of all, we get this electromagnetic wave and gamma rays, and that's followed by a massive incoming of cosmic dust, which would then blot out the sun. But I mean, I was in contact with LaViolette about this, although he seems to think this is encoded into the tarot and also into the signs of the zodiac, and implies that we are sort of overdue for another one of these. He said that he thinks that we're looking at a minor version of it at the moment, because at the time he wrote his book, Earth Under Fire, the state of the sun didn't sort of imply that we're anywhere near a major event, but that it might be a minor kind of event.
Right.
But of course, since he's written his book, the sun has got a lot more active.
Okay, right. So another possibility would be this sort of super wave that would, I presume, would make life on Earth very difficult, presumably. I mean, for us particularly.
Well, if it was the full-blown one, yes, you'd be looking at a nuclear winter, really. But if it's a minor one, that would be an electromagnetic pulse, which would have a similar effect to burning out those transistors in vehicles, and probably information systems like computers would all burn out and everything.
And this fits in with the sunspot theory as well, doesn't it? Is that right? You're saying about activity on the sun and so on?
Well, yes. Now, it seems to fit in better. You mentioned that the sun has been increasing its activities. They found also that that, you know, as we know, the Earth's weather changes are getting more severe as well. But throughout the whole solar system, it now transpires that all the planets in the solar system have had recent changes to their weather and to their magnetic envelopes. And there's a Russian geologist who's been looking at this called Alexei Dmitriev. And his explanation for it is that the whole solar system is moving as the whole solar system travels around the galaxy about every 250 million years. He theorizes that there's these structures coming out from the center of the galaxy called magnetized bands of plasma. Because there is a similar structure at a solar system level, but where they're quite diffuse though, so I mean we go through those every year, there's several of them as we go around the solar system. He theorizes that there's these ones on a galactic level, and that the whole solar system is traveling into a dense magnetized plasma beam at the moment, and that's what's triggering these changes on the Earth, on the Sun, and throughout the whole solar system. So that actually seems to fit the information a little bit better than Laviolette's theory. And Dmitriev also says that this, what we are looking at, for example, it explains the increase of light balls, plasma balls in the atmosphere. And he's done a close study on those. And there's lots of different types.
Are these the same sort of balls we see over crop circles when they're forming?
Yeah, that is one kind. Yes, there are several different types. He calls them vacuum domains because at the centre of a tornado, which is a vacuum, you do get these strange balls of light. They have several things in common, the various different varieties. There are differences between them, but basically plasma is the fourth state of matter. You've got solid, liquid, gas, and then plasma. And it's like a gas with all the electrons stripped off, and it can actually float through solid objects. But the weird thing is they behave as if they're intelligent. All right. There is now information from a study that shows that they have practically all the qualities of life, these things. And so it's possible that although they're transient structures, these plasma balls, that somehow an intelligence attaches itself to them and can affect reality while it's in that shape. Right. So it could be that's why there's the association with crop formations. As you say, intelligence attached to the plasma ball would be, I mean, it's a whole other discussion about crop formations.
Absolutely.
But the fact is that all the things that the scientists have found out about crop formations show that plasma is involved in it somehow, so it fits into that perfectly.
Have there been any crop circles that have sort of fingered 2012 in particular? I know they communicate a lot of things to us, and a lot of people who are watching out for these things have got signs to show they're on the right path and so on, but I just wonder if you've got anything particular about 2012?
Well, there are several which refer to the Maya calendar. I mean...
Oh, yes, that's right, I've seen those, yeah.
They do seem to reflect the numbering of the Maya calendar. Some people have tried to read more than that into them, and I don't agree with them, basically. But yes, I think there's a general connection with the whole Maya numbering system, and on general terms, I would say yes.
Because the funny thing about those crop circles, of course, is I still get people, you know, my kind of nationalist friends, I'll mention something like crop circles to them, and they'll still try and convince me that these two guys, Doug and Dave, did it with a plank of wood within a couple of hours one night. And when you see those ones with kind of Mayan numbering systems, I mean, to start with, I doubt Doug and Dave know anything about Mayan numbering systems. And you think the complexity that would be required to do this thing and to create it in the time which it appeared, which is usually less than 4 hours, or perhaps instantly, we have certain witness reports, so they're instant. You know, it just cannot be done, basically. It just cannot physically be done. It's impossible. Yeah. And the amount of people you'd need, they'd be trampling the crops down and everything else. So the conclusion we can come to about something like this, clearly there is a technology involved which is not available publicly, but then you've got to decide whether that technology then belongs to the shadow government or whether it belongs to perhaps alien races trying to show us what's going on. And again, I think if you're looking on the positive side, I tend to want to think it's alien races showing us what's going on, but we should never rule out that these things are distractions. Yeah. But I want to just talk a little bit, because we've looked at some of the stuff from the ancient myths, we looked at the time curve, we looked at some of the scientific stuff and the near-death experiences about 2012. But one thing I do want to mention, of course, is the Bible code has some kind of prediction of 2012. Is that right?
Oh, yes. It says that there's going to be a comet coming into the solar system, and that it will crumble into pieces, and it seems like we'll be showered with the bits.
Right. And how did you get the 2012 date from that? Is it just...
Oh, because the way that the Bible code works, it looks for skip codes. It wouldn't have been possible before the computer age because it would have just taken too long. But it takes, for any particular code, it will take a certain number of letters out and then highlight...
Yeah, the sort of every fifth letter or every 50th or whatever. Yeah.
And then it compacts those letters together. In the Hebrew alphabet, letters have a numerical value. And so, for example, when the guy was doing a search for 20, it was among other years, he was just seeing what would happen in different years. And the Hebrew calendar has its own year system. So the Hebrew year that equates to our 2012, when it got to that one, those numbers equate to four Hebrew letters together. So when that appeared on one of the screens, you then search for whatever other words are also on that same screen, and that's how it got associated with the comet, and I will crumble it and tear it to pieces.
No, that's interesting. I mean, my own personal kind of odyssey really started with the Bible code, or the Torah code, just to fill the listeners in on the background to this. And this is obviously the first five books of what we now think of as the Bible or the Old Testament. And I actually picked it up as to laugh at, really, because that was my kind of state of mind as a rationalist. But of course, as a true rationalist, I always wanted to test things out. And thank God I did, because when I started reading it, I couldn't find the counter argument. And then I started reading stuff by mathematicians and so on. And to give you an idea of how reliable the Bible code has been, I mean, it seems to have predicted the death of Kennedy, for example, the date on which Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the first Gulf War. But most crucially, the assassination of Rabin, where the guy actually predicted it and sent it to him, said, look, the Bible code is telling you you're going to be assassinated, mate. And of course, Rabin, probably thinking it was some lunatic, screwed up, put it in the bin. And of course, sure enough, Rabin was shot. But it's not just that. It's the fact that the guy who shot him, a guy called Amir, his name then appeared in the Bible code in the same area as Rabin. And this was at odds of millions to one, basically. So it's a kind of proof that certainly, I don't think it's necessarily saying that the future is set in stone, because then there'll be no point in this existence. We'd just be walking along like a computer path or something. But what it does suggest is that it's giving us the information that we need to know now, that we've never been able to do this before, because you say we haven't got computers. Now we have computers, we can do skip codes of however many letters we like, and therefore we can read the thing more easily. But then I do point out that it is subject to problems, because somebody's put in, you know, Twin Towers and Bin Laden, and they occur. But then again, it's not telling you whether Bin Laden carried it out or whether Bin Laden's going to be blamed. So there are obviously shortcomings to it.
And another thing is that Drosnin himself has found evidence that the actual discovery of the code, which was also encoded in there, encodes that from that point onwards we'll have a choice of futures. So the actual discovery of the code somehow gives us a way in, so that we can choose. We have a choice, basically, because we can know our futures.
Yeah,
that it gives us more choice. So from that point on, he started trying to get into peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and trying to sort something out.
But unfortunately, it hasn't worked, really, has it? I mean, this is the funny thing about it, because as he points out, when he first wrote the stuff, some of the predictions in the mid-1990s, the world was becoming a more peaceful place.
Yeah.
And the problem was, of course, is that in those 10 years, the world has become a more violent place. And one of the predictions of the Bible code is nuclear apocalypse in the Middle East in this year, basically. And we've come perilously close a few times, I think, this year.
Yeah.
Be fair to say. And I say, because it's not fixed in stone, we can probably avoid it. I don't think it says that the Bible code is necessarily wrong. But the fact is, obviously, it starts to mention... The Bible code mentions this stuff as well. It mentions the comet. I mean, I know some of the predictions have talked about perhaps Nibiru coming back, coinciding with this 2012 date, but other people have different theories about that.
Yeah, I've looked at that material and I don't find it very convincing, actually. There is a lot of it boils down to what Zechariah Sitchin decoded from the ancient Sumerian texts. I mean, there's not that many people who are expert in deciphering cuneiform texts. But there is one. A book called The Genius of the Few by Joy and... the O'Briens, anyway.
No.
This guy is one of the few people who can also read Sumerian texts. He found a lot of things in common with Sitchin's findings, which was amazing. But basically, that these ancient Sumerian gods, it seems, according to his findings as well as Sitchin, genetically engineered our ancestors by, as a crossbreed between themselves and probably an ape that was on already on this planet. And that they were the gods, and the whole Garden of Eden story seems to fit in well with that. And then Jehovah then is turns out later to be one of these Anunnaki, one of these gods, but one that's gone badly wrong and has to be told off and taken off and told off because he's got a bit megalomaniac.
They want to destroy mankind, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yes, the difference was between the O'Brien's book and Sitchin's. They didn't, although they found that these were sort of intelligent humanoids flying around in flying machines, that they there was no conclusion that they came from another planet or nothing about Nibiru. That is all Zachariah Sitchin's conclusion.
Oh, right, I didn't realise that. Because I mean, I, and what I understood from anyway from people who've studied this, that, that those people who have studied Nibiru and so on don't think it's coming around. We're about the middle of the Nibiru cycle. We're very far away from the return of Nibiru.
Yeah.
So it's I think that's unlikely to be 2012.
Yeah, even Sitchin himself didn't put the return of Nibiru around now.
No. So yeah, so we have a whole kind of variety of cultures. We have sort of science indicating this and so on. So, I mean, presumably you're convinced that something is going to happen in 2012.
Well, yeah, the signs are that something is going on here. There's just too many things converging on the same point. All these people, a lot of these people I've spoken to personally have come back with visions from altered states of consciousness. They knew nothing about anything to do with 2012 before that. In particular, there's five people I know who've had near-death experiences, including Daniel Brinkley, have come back and said something is going to happen in 2012 to do with consciousness changes and earth changes.
It's also what I find fascinating, because and I went to your talk at the Big Green Gathering, which I thought was fascinating, was these kind of exponential graphs you were showing of things like of issues we associate with spiritual development, like living in the present, like greater access to the collective consciousness. And when I heard your talk, I thought it was absolutely fascinating, because it was exactly what I needed here at the time, because in some ways I'm kind of part of that. I was somebody who, say, wasn't spiritual at all 2 years ago and have gone on a very rapid spiritual journey. And some people do talk about this being us acceding to the fifth dimension. Now, can you explain a bit more about that?
Well, yes, dimensions. These terms are a bit loaded, really, dimensions and densities, and we're trying to get our heads around things by using whatever terminology we can get hold of. But if you take the Maori prophecy, this is a good example, because the Maoris recently said that their creation myth, in which apparently the earth was created when the earth god and the sky god were in a close embrace, and then as a result of that they had children, one of whom was the war god called Tain, and they call mankind the children of Tain, the war god. The myth goes on, the children pushed their parents apart, and that's why the sky is up there and the earth is down here. But the rest of the myth says that one day when the children of Tain, i.e. mankind, are too distracted and have forgotten the old ways to even bother and notice what's happening, that the earth, that the sky will come crashing down onto the earth again, and that they will call this event Kahinga Tiarai, which translates as the curtain will fall. So that's always been taken to mean like the end of the play and a game over situation. But a young Maori got to interview the old Maoris and asked them about this terminology, and apparently the actual words have mutated over the years, and the translation should and was originally the veil will dissolve, and that veil is the word that they use when they say that you travel beyond the veil when you die. So what we're talking about is whatever, if you want to call that the fifth dimension, wherever people go when they die, that's what is going to become accessible to us.
Well, I find it's fascinating, because in Kabbalah there are, as in quantum mechanics, there are 10, possibly 11 dimensions, but they are referred to as veils that block us out from the light, basically. and partly obviously the spiritual journey of Kabbalah, getting closer to the light. So that idea of veils dissolving. And I think this comes in Islam as well, doesn't it? I think. And the book of Revelations refers to this as well, about the sky collapsing in and changing.
Yes, it will roll up like a scroll, I think it says.
Yeah, something like that, which again implies, I think, some kind of access to the fifth dimension. And that we will, as human beings, live in a completely different way.
Well, the Pachacuti prophecy of the Peruvians says that in 2012, there's a whole process which started in 1990, leading up to 2012, and the culmination is called the Tarapé Pacha, the Golden Age, or the Age of Meeting Ourselves Again, and that will occur when the three shamanic worlds, you have the overworld, the underworld, and the everyday world, they will all converge. So you've got, like, in that model, you have three realms or three dimensions or densities or whatever you want to call them, all converging together.
So yeah, we're talking about the kind of accession to possibly the fifth dimension in a sense. I mean, I mean, obviously a lot of people out there will find that extraordinary. I don't find that extraordinary. I believe other dimensions exist, and of course our brains are decrypted to only interpret these four dimensions, and therefore in a normal state, obviously when you do take more DMT or whatever, it seems that you get access to those other worlds because you change the frequency of the brain. In the same way that if you're on one radio station, you change the dial, you're on a different frequency, you pick up a different radio station.
Yeah.
And I think access to the fifth dimension means, and I think in Islam it makes it very clear that if you're up to the fifth dimension, that means you can see all the dimensions below you, but not those above you. But there is a bit in your book, isn't there, about the kind of the pineal gland and how that may be affected by the magnetic switch.
Yes, there is magnetite in the pineal gland and in the sinus, the bones of the sinuses in the skull here. So any geomagnetic fluctuations are going to affect our consciousness, because there is evidence that the actual secretions of the pineal gland, which, as we mentioned, it produces this this hallucinogen DMT, but it also, it's now, as well as Dr. Rick Strassman's findings, we have a Dr. Calloway from Finland who was doing research at the same time, and there is anything up to about six hallucinogens altogether produced in the pineal gland, four beta-carbolines, dimethyltryptamine, and 5-MeO-DMT as well. Those beta-carbolines, very closely related to another chemical in ayahuasca called harmine. Originally, harmine was called telepathine when it was first discovered because of its effects. Then they found on further research that it had already been found, extracted and named after the plant it was found in, which was Syrian rue, known as Peganum harmala. So it's called harmine. But as I say, that has a telepathic effect, and that was recognised as soon as they discovered it. And that's produced in our own pineal gland as well. And the pineal gland is affected by magnetic changes, just the same as people who have temporal lobe epilepsy and schizophrenia are very, very sensitive to minute changes in the Earth's magnetic field, such as happens when we have solar storms. And so those people will probably be the first people who will be sensitive to any major changes in the Earth's magnetic field.
Well, actually, because I've always often wondered.
Hello there. I'm back online there. Sorry to cut that interview there. But we got the interviewer earlier on at Jeff's place in East Grinstead. And we talked about a lot more fascinating stuff. So we couldn't actually fit it all into the hour's programme. So if you want to actually hear the rest of that interview, the conclusion, and in fact the full version, you have to get it downloaded on the podcast. But there's one thing I did want to say about this thing that I forgot to mention at the beginning, actually, was how I was actually taken by the light to a talk by Jeff at the Big Green Gathering. In fact, I'd missed his talk at the Sunrise Festival because I'd done my ankle in. But before I'd done my ankle in that festival, I'd seen this guy in the audience. I thought, I've got to talk to him for some reason. Don't know why. It was totally inexplicable at the time. Couldn't actually talk to him. So missed the talk, and then I was taken by the light at the Big Green Gathering to his talk. I had no idea it was on. I just felt myself as being drawn by this beam around the festival. I was thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I wandering around here? And then sure enough, I found myself in front of this board outside a tent, and it said 2012 Jeff Stray. And then I walked in, and it was only obviously when I first time I saw him, I realised this is the guy I'd seen at my talk that I, the Sunrise Festival, that I, for some reason, knew I needed to talk to. And then, of course, I sat down and listened to what he had to say, and I realised that I'd been taken there by the light, because that was exactly what I had to hear at that moment. Because one of the most fascinating things that has been plotted on these sort of exponential graphs of things like technological development and so on is also spiritual development. And so there's going to be a lot more collective consciousness and a lot more living in the present, people not being obsessed with their past and letting that bother them, and at the same time not being overly worried about the future. So the whole thing is happening exponentially. It's scientific, but it's also a spiritual thing. And this is why I don't believe it's that absurd to think that we won't join the fifth dimension, because one of the predictions for 2012 is that the dead will again walk the earth. And of course, that's very interesting, because you know, if we do access the fifth dimension, what ayahuasca and shaman tend to suggest to us is that the dead are there, our spirit relatives are there, we can go and talk to the dead or whatever. So if we were to access the fifth dimension, the dead would literally be with us walking the earth again. And I've just been passed a note now via web on iTunes, David Shaler podcast. So David Shaler podcast is on the web via iTunes. That's where we're going to, that's where you're going to be able to download that one. And what was I talking about? I was talking about, yes, this spiritual change and the Big Green Gathering. And no, not anymore, because we're coming towards the end of the program. And what was I going to talk about then?
Next week's show.
Next week's show, we've got no idea what we're doing, because we never have any idea what we're doing from week to week. But I think everybody should hopefully continue to listen into Truth Radio. I was going to say something. I can't remember what it was, though, now. You've lost my track. I don't know what it was. I was going to finish on something. I can't remember what it was now. Damn. Shouldn't have had that smoke, should I? anyway, I've got to say my line. Conquer the fear and embrace the love. Go.